Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has brought us to this Sabbath and this opportunity to gather virtually in this Zoom room to study the Parsha and to see the comments from Kana and what she has to say, and then to study some of the highlights. We're grateful to you, Lord, for what you have provided in this opportunity each week for us to gather like this from various places and to come together in ways that without this technology, we would not otherwise be able to. We thank you, Lord, for Torah and your word that you have provided for us. I pray that you will help us in what we do today, that you would touch us, and you would bless us and anoint us, that our hearts would be open to you as you inscribe your Torah upon our hearts, as we learn to walk in your ways. I ask, Lord, on behalf of these that are in this gathering today, that you will bless them and you will touch them and you would help them, and that you would touch and bless Bob while he is away and strengthen and bless him today. We thank you for your help. Bless the name of the Lord. Amen and amen. So I'm sitting in today for Bob, who is away visiting family, and I'm happy to be here and to present this week's Parsha Sabbath study. And it's a double Parsha, Acharit Mot, after the death, and Kedoshim, be holy. And the commentary that I've chosen from Kana Weisberg that we're going to read and look at together is the first of those two, Acharit Mot, after the death. So as what we typically do, we'll look at Kana's commentary and read through that together. And then afterwards, I want to consider some highlights from Kana's commentary and some things that she references for further study and further highlight. So Kana begins, and she entitles this particular commentary, A Response to Personal Suffering. She writes, you've experienced a difficult and overloaded day. The tension is mounting and your head is pounding. Before your headache becomes utterly unbearable, you swallow two Tylenols. To your great relief, within several minutes, the pain has subsided and you can continue working. You think you're now functioning as your normal self. But think again. A new study by researchers at Ohio State University found that while acetaminophen, the main medical ingredient used in Tylenol and many other pain relievers, dulls your own pain, it also dulls your empathy to the trials and tribulations of others. In this study, participants from two groups were tested. One group was given a placebo.
How is everybody? I just wanted to say hi. I am painting rocks with my grandson, but I just wanted to say hi to everybody. And Roderick, I wanted to ask you if to make sure that the closed captioning was on.
It is now enabled.
Great. Very good. Nice to see everybody. I will, Lord willing, I will see you Wednesday night, but I'm going to run back outside and keep painting rocks with my grandson, okay? But really great to see everybody. Love you.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Roderick. Appreciate you doing this.
Absolutely. It's good to see you, Bob. So let's go back to the commentary and we'll pick up again. I'm going to back up to the third paragraph. A new study by researchers at Ohio State University found that while acetophen, the main medical ingredient used in Tylenol and many other pain relievers, dulls your pain, it also dulls your empathy to the trials and tribulations of others. In this study, participants from two groups were tested. One group was given a placebo pill, and the other was given acetophen. After the medicine took effect, the groups were each asked to read sad stories of individuals experiencing challenges and distress. Each group was then asked to rate the pain of the characters. And those who had taken the acetophen minimized the pain, while the placebo group had greater empathy for them. Empathy is our ability to put ourselves in other people's shoes and feel their emotional landscape from their own perspective. Apparently, the part of the brain that activates when you're feeling pain is the same part that is activated when you're imagining someone else feeling the same pain. And if your pain center is dulled, so too is your empathy toward another's agony. Reading this study made me wonder if the converse is also true. Can experiencing a painful situation actually increase our compassion? While empathy comes more naturally to some than others, if you have experienced a particular challenge or trauma, can you use your experience to become more sensitized to the depth of another person's pain? Akari mote means after the death and refers to the death of Aaron's two sons, which is the greatest pain a parent can ever experience. And Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, each took his pan, put fire in them, and placed incense upon it. And they brought before the Lord foreign fire, which had not commanded. And fire went forth from before the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord spoke when he said, 'I will be sanctified through those near me, and before all the people I will be glorified.'" And Aaron was silent. She continues, "Aaron's silence is certainly not a natural response. What did it express? Aaron remained silent out of a sense of subservience to God. He believed, as difficult as it was to comprehend, that it was God's will that this tragedy should befall him, and so he remained silent. The Midrash Rabbah explains that because Aaron was silent, he was rewarded that God spoke exclusively to him, teaching him directly a portion of laws, whereas usually it would be in conjunction or through Moses. Aaron's silence conveyed his awareness of his limited knowledge in understanding God's justice in running the world. This belief caused the expansion of knowledge in Aaron's case by being taught God's laws. Though we are not expected to react like Aaron to such painful predicaments, our lives are rarely easy. To survive our challenges, we need to cultivate our faith that God runs the world. This enables us to reach a level of silence or acceptance, even when conditions aren't the way we would have ideally liked. Losing one's children is perhaps the worst pain a parent ever has to face. Nevertheless, it did not transform Aaron into a bitter person. He remained the same minister of love, overflowing with empathy for his fellows. Hillel said, "Be of the disciples of Aaron, who loved his fellow creatures and drew them close to Torah," as we find in the Ethics of the Fathers 1:12. The Midrash Avot de Rabbi Natan 12:3 recounts, when Aaron would pass a wicked man, he would greet him warmly. The next day, when the wicked man would want to engage in sin, he would think to himself, "Woe is me. How will I be able to look upon Aaron tomorrow when he greets me with love?" Others would think, "If Aaron only knew the hidden things of my heart and the evil of my deeds, he would not allow himself to look at me, let alone speak to me. Yet he considers me to be a fine person. Let me therefore make his words and thoughts true by changing my ways." The Midrash also tells us when Aaron saw two people involved in a quarrel, he would say to each of them without the knowledge of the other, "My child, see how your friend is berating himself with remorse because of what he did to you? He asked me to approach you to seek your forgiveness." When the two would meet, their quarrel would disappear and they would embrace. This was Aaron's character. He transformed people through his empathy, love, and confidence in them. "I have met people," Connor writes, "who have suffered terrible challenges in their lives, debilitating sicknesses, financial crises, and appalling emotional traumas. Some of these individuals have used their pain and suffering to transform themselves into greater people. Overflowing with empathy, the depth of their pain seems to reflect the depth of their ability to feel the hurt of another and to take action, to proactively do something to help. While none of us ever wants to experience serious suffering in our lives, perhaps we can view our challenges as opportunities to grow into greater, more empathetic individuals. And while the researchers in Ohio never intended to prove that, perhaps this paradox can have even greater ramifications on how we function as human beings. This might be a challenging parsha for some of you. If you are someone who has lost a child, young or old, if you are a parent and you have lost a child, then this parsha is going to connect with you and you are going to connect with it. And it might be a challenge. If you are a person who has experienced trauma in your history, or maybe right now you're struggling with something that's called toxic stress, or maybe you have a history of adversity that's not yet been resolved, well, in many ways, you can identify and connect with this parsha. And you may have some particular reactions that you're experiencing right now, just hearing what Kana has to say. You might find it encouraging, but you might find it just difficult to be totally open to what she's representing here. And I take a pause here before we go further in this study just to acknowledge that we're looking at from this parsha, as Kana entitles it, a response to personal suffering. The parsha itself is entitled After the Death. And so when we look at the words of Torah and the Lord coming to speak to Aaron, it's in the aftermath that he just lost his two sons. In a very traumatic way, they died. They died in a big ball of fire. And it doesn't matter why. It's just hard, isn't it? Can we appreciate that? That without getting into yet the whys and why did this happen or what was going on, what's the backdrop, before we go any further, we have to see this from the human element, because that's who we are. We're human beings. We have to stand and understand from a human point of view, this was a very difficult day for Aaron, for Aaron's wife, for Aaron's other children. And that's the stage that we have to sit. That's the point of view we want to sit from. And I don't know. I don't know where this goes, except it's my hope and it's my trust that somehow in this parsha that we can, all of us, find not only a hope, but we can find an encouragement to be resilient and to not allow the circumstances to continue overwhelming us and cause us to retreat from walking in the ways of the Lord. So there's a couple things that I would like to address in this study today before we go too much further into the Torah study part itself, but because Kana raises as an example this research that was done in Ohio. And she mentions there in point number one of your notes, a new study by researchers at Ohio State University found that while acetophen, the main medical ingredient used in Tylenol and many other pain relievers, dulls your own pain, it also dulls your empathy to the trials and tribulations of others. So I'm familiar with the study in Ohio at Ohio State University, but it's not a new study. It might be new at Ohio State University and what they were doing and how they were approaching it. But what is found from this research is not new. This is something we have known for a very long time in terms of pharmaceuticals and what they do and can do and what they don't do and cannot do when we take them. So I'm going to offer you a brain science 101, if you will allow me. So I'm going to hold up my three fingers to represent the three rungs of a ladder, or the three major positions of a ladder. So this bottom finger would represent the bottom of the ladder. This middle finger would represent the middle part of a ladder. And this top finger would represent the top part of a ladder. And I'm using the metaphor of a ladder to represent the three primary nervous systems in the human body. And I'd like for you to imagine these three positions overlaid on the brain. And so these three positions of the nervous system, the three different nervous systems, correspond to the top of our brain, the middle of our brain, and the bottom of our brain. So you and I are at our very best when this nervous system here at the top is the dominant voice. And that is called the ventral vagal system. And when it's dominant, these other two are still active, but this is the one who's dominant. And when it's dominant, this nervous system up here with the ventral vagal, you and I are at our best. We are experiencing life optimally. So when we have a desire to walk in God's ways, that's going to be most likely to happen when this nervous system is dominant. This nervous system here controls the midbrain, and it's called the sympathetic nervous system. When it's dominant, this one's gone offline. So this one now is in charge. And when this is in charge, we have what's called a reactive adaptation. We also know reactive adaptation as fight or flight. If this is not in charge, and this is not in charge, then this is the dominant nervous system, and it's the dorsal vagal. And this comes from the brainstem. And now we're no longer in a fight or flight mode trying to defend ourselves against danger or a perceived threat. We're experiencing reactive mitigation. It's an emotional dissociation. And the whole purpose of reduced or the reduced emotional association through emotional dissociation is to reduce cognitive awareness. It's sort of like, it's too overwhelming to think about it. I want to stop thinking about it. I don't want to know about it. I don't want to be aware of it. And that is what the acetophen acetophen is an analgesic. So any analgesic medicine taking orally or applied topically serves the purpose to mitigate, to reduce awareness. Now, to further understand this, let me offer you a little illustration. Imagine you're walking through the forest and you see a bear. The moment you see the bear, this nervous system is no longer dominant. It was dominant a moment ago before you saw the bear. You were able to enjoy the birds and the flowers and the trees and the breeze through the trees and the sun. And you just had a picnic with your family and friends, and you're just having a wonderful time and you're taking it all in. And this is the nervous system that's dominant. Then you see a bear, and the bear sees you and starts to move towards you. And in that moment, you don't want to be thinking about it. You want to react, because if you think about it, you die. You want to react. And this nervous system becomes dominant, the sympathetic, and you're either going to fight that bear or you're going to run away from that bear. Now imagine you're finishing your picnic in the forest and you don't see a bear, you see 10 bears. And in that moment, your brain, without asking your permission, it's just going to do it on its own. It's going to shut off this, it's going to shut off this, and the dorsal vagal is going to get dominant, because in that moment, you're just going to freeze and hope that none of the 10 bears sees you or your family. I mean, I'm taking the time to explain this because one of the things that happens when the sympathetic becomes dominant is muscle tension. And one of the first muscles to get tense and constrict is right here in the throat, which makes it difficult to speak. If you've ever listened to someone who was making a presentation to an audience, and if you've ever done this, this might have happened to you. You were a little nervous about speaking in front of people because you weren't comfortable with it. Maybe some of you experienced this when you were sharing at the end of a Sabbath study and you were taking the moment to share your story about how you came to be a part of this journey, and you're uncomfortable being on camera and talking to people, and you felt your voice drop out and it was difficult and you were like you were straining to get a breath. That's because your body is perceiving threat and your muscle tension right here, and it's constricting your throat. So when the dorsal vagal becomes dominant, the muscle tension here is so incredibly tense, it's very difficult for people to speak. And in this week's parsha, Aaron is silent. And he's just experienced the death of two of his children. And it doesn't matter why. They're dead. And they died in a very traumatic way. And for a dad, for a family, that's just really difficult, whatever the reason. And then in the aftermath, to have the creator of the universe speak to you. How many of you, after having a traumatic experience, you want to stand in the spotlight? Or would you rather, when you've had a traumatic experience, you would rather not be noticed by anybody because you just need some time? That's mitigation. That's that distancing. She writes, empathy is our ability to put ourselves in other people's shoes and feel their emotional landscape from their own perspective. I am a fan of Connor Weisberg, and I have been for a long time. And I'm not a woman, but a lot of her teachings are directed towards women, and I've benefited from them, even though I'm not a woman. There's enough feminine in me, evidently, to benefit from Connor Weisberg, and I'm happy to admit that, and I don't think that compromises my dignity in any way. I am a fan of Connor Weisberg, which makes my next point here a little bit more challenging for me to say. I respectfully disagree with her on this point. Respectfully, because her definition of empathy could easily be the definition for sympathy. Empathy and sympathy are different, and in a moment I want to talk about that. But they also have some things in common. And this is the point that she makes here is actually what sympathy and empathy have in common. They both is an ability or an action on the part of a person to put themselves in the other person's shoes and to feel into what they're experiencing. That's what they hold. That's what empathy holds in common. But empathy and sympathy are also very different. And there's an example of both in the book of John. So first of all, empathy identifies with the deficits. Sympathy identifies with the deficits. So what does that mean, that sympathy identifies with the deficits? It means that if you experience the loss of someone close to you and you're telling me that story and I'm putting myself in your shoes, I am going to feel towards your loss. I'm going to sympathy feels about your loss. Your loss is your deficit. But it also loses sight of the bigger story or the larger truth. Empathy does not identify with the deficit. It identifies with the asset. It's still emotionally attuned to you that you've had a loss. Empathy is attuned to you when you have a loss, but it's identifying with your capacities and your assets. So let's look at some examples here from the book of John to see if we can get some clarification on this. So the story is found in John chapter 11, and you're probably familiar with the story that Yeshua is in one location. Mary and Martha are in another location with their brother Lazarus. They're in Bethany. Yeshua is somewhere else. And news comes to Yeshua where he's at, that he is being asked by Mary and Martha to drop everything and come running to Bethany because Lazarus is dying. He is sick and he is near death. And we read in John 11 that Yeshua doesn't drop everything and he doesn't go running. In fact, he stays where he's at a couple more days. And Lazarus dies. Eventually, Yeshua makes his way to Bethany. And so when we look at verse 16, So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, the disciples are with Yeshua. And so when he stayed where he was at, they stayed with him. Now that Yeshua has decided a couple of days later, let's go to Bethany and visit Mary and Martha and see what's going on with Lazarus. And they had gotten word that Lazarus had died. And so one of the disciples, Thomas, called the twin, said to his other disciples, let's also go, as in, let's also go with Yeshua to Bethany, that we may die with him, die with Lazarus. That's the sympathy. And this is an example of sympathy that's gone to such a distance that we're just identifying with the deficit. We're identifying with the death so much, maybe we should die too. Verse 19, many of the Jews had come to Mary and Martha to console them concerning their brother. Consoling is something you do when you're sympathizing. When the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary rise and go quickly out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to go to the tomb and weep there. That's what sympathy does. It presumes that what you're going to do is go to the graveside and weep because they're identifying with the loss. Verse 33, when Yeshua saw her weeping and the Jews had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. So the first thing we know about Yeshua when he arrives in Bethany is he drawn into the sympathy? No. Instead, when he witnesses the sympathy, he's deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. Now, before I go any further, we have, all of us, this is a tendency we all have, is to see things from a binary point of view. We see it as either good or bad, right or wrong. It's one way or it's the other way. And if that's how we look at sympathy and empathy, we might feel judged. And that's not the purpose of this lesson, is not to judge anyone or to shame anyone. In other words, there is a place to be sympathetic. There is a time to be sympathetic. But we want to recognize what sympathy is, and we also want to recognize its limitations. But there is a place for sympathy. But let's look at it in contrast. Empathy. Because empathy identifies with assets, while at the same time staying emotionally attuned, emotionally, not cognitively, emotionally attuned to the other person because they have suffered loss. So now we're going to get a picture, a snapshot, if you will, of what empathy looks like, and it's in our Messiah, Yeshua. Yeshua wept. So people who are being empathetic also weep. Yeshua wept, but he's not weeping over the loss. He's weeping over something else. Then Yeshua, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Yeshua said, take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead for 4 days. Notice where Martha's attention is. It's on the deficit. Sympathy leads us more and more and more to focus on the deficit. What's the deficit? He's been dead for a while. He's been buried in this tomb for a while. He's already stinking. There's an odor. That's a focus on the deficit. What did Yeshua say? Verse 40, Yeshua said to her, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? That's the larger truth. That's what empathy does. It leads us to the larger truth. So they took away the stone, and Yeshua lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me. That's what empathy does. It leads you to the larger truth. What's the larger truth? God always hears us. Now, can I bring you back to the three nervous systems of the brain for a moment? This ventral vagal, when it's dominant, comes from up here. That's our thinking brain. But when we are so full of remorse, when we've experienced such a trauma, we're perceiving threat. We're overwhelmed by our loss. This part is no longer dominant. Either the sympathetic is dominant and we're fighting or we're running away, or this one's dominant, the dorsal vagal, and we're just emotionally numb. Either way, we're not thinking. If I'm not thinking, I'm not remembering. That's not a curse. That's not because of sin. That's not because we're broken. That's not because there's something wrong with us. That's because we're a human being and life circumstances has just kicked the breath out of us. And we can't be expected to think when we're so overwhelmed. And we're not always able to speak because we're just overwhelmed. By the way, it's God who designed the human body this way. We're functioning the way we're supposed to function when these things happen to us. And so Yeshua in this story says, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? He's not reprimanding Martha. He's gently reminding her, Martha, you're just overwhelmed right now. And your memory is not what it would be if your ventral vagal was dominant. It's not dominant right now. You're upset. And it's logical that you would be upset because your brother just died. And even though you've got faith and even though you're trying to trust me and you're looking to walk in the ways of the Lord, it's really difficult for you right now. You're worried about your brother's body odor. So I just want to remind you that if you continue to trust in the Lord, you will see his glory. That's what empathy does. Empathy doesn't reprimand someone because they're weeping. Empathy doesn't jump on someone's case or confront their behavior because they're not meeting the spiritual expectations. It's just a gentle reminder. I know why you're weeping. I know why you're upset. I know why you're not remembering important things. I'm here. I'm going to be here for you. Empathy comes alongside and is that gentle reminder. And then it even impacts the way Yeshua prays. Because if Yeshua was just thinking of himself, he wouldn't say, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. And so he wants to clarify to the Father why he's saying that. I know you always hear me, but I'm saying this on the account of the people who are standing around, the people who are listening to me right now pray to you, Father. I'm saying what I am to you because they're listening to my words, and I want to help encourage them to believe that you sent me. That's what empathy does. Moving on. And Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, each took his pan, put fire in them, and placed incense upon it, and they brought before the Lord foreign fire, which he had not commanded. And fire went forth from before the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Now, that's from Leviticus 10. The passage for this week's Parsha is Leviticus 16. The Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, who died when they drew close to the presence of the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, tell your brother Aaron that he is not to come at will into the sanctuary behind the curtain in front of the cover that is upon the ark, lest he die, for I appear in the cloud over the cover. Thus only shall Aaron enter the sanctuary. So what we have here is a calendar difference. And we understand this. Rambam states that this took place on the day after the death of Aaron's two sons, following the divine prohibition against drinking wine or strong drink during the sacred service. And we also learn that this event on the day that Nadab and Abihu die, this is happening because they attempted to go into the Holy of Holies on the first of Nisan. Do any of you remember when it is right for the high priest to go into the Holy of Holies? Not on the first of Nisan, but on the 10th of Tishrei, the Day of Atonement. These two sons of Aaron, first of all, are not authorized to go into the Holy of Holies, only the high priest, who in this time is their father Aaron. But even Aaron is not allowed to go into the Holy of Holies except one day a year, the 10th of Tishrei. So not only are these two sons going into the Holy of Holies and they're not authorized to do so, they're doing it on a day that no one is supposed to be going in there. So we understand why they're dying, but does that change? Does that make any difference for Aaron? And then that brings us to, and Aaron was silent. And so Connor writes, Aaron remained silent out of a sense of subservience to God. He believed, as difficult as it was to comprehend, that it was God's will that his tragedy should befall him, and so he remained silent. In another place in her commentary, Connor writes that his silence was not usual. It was abnormal. And I respectfully disagree. There are times when someone experiences a traumatic moment and this sympathetic nervous system is what's dominant, and they scream, they yell, they curse, they're angry, they're aggressive, because that's a demonstration of that fight or flight. No, no, this can't be right. No, my sons can't have died. No, no. That would have been a reasonable reaction, would it not? This can't be true. Or maybe it's just so difficult, Aaron turns and he just runs away. He retreats. But we don't see either one of those in Aaron. What we see is the silence. And what I'm saying is that it's very congruent when the dorsal vagal nervous system is dominant. It's not seeing one bear in the forest. It's being overwhelmed by 10 bears, by 20 bears. It is so hard. It is so inconceivable that this has happened. Aaron is probably very aware. This is not Yom Kippur, so you're not supposed to be going in the first place. He's also very aware his sons were not authorized. He knows that. Cognitively, he knows that. But have you ever had the experience that what you know cognitively creates confusion in you emotionally? Because there's a confluence of things that happened. Yes, my son shouldn't be in there doing this, but they did, and they're my sons, and I love them, and now they died. I know why God killed them, but I wish that hadn't happened. And so I trust God, but I don't like what God just did. I love my sons, but I don't like what they just did. And there's this, all this information, and it mounts and it mounts and it mounts and it overwhelms us. And in Aaron, I got nothing to say. God's talking to me and I don't know what he wants me to say. So the nature of Aaron's silence may not be as certain as we're being told. And what I'd like to look at now is several examples, both in Torah and in the New Covenant writings and in the rabbinical writings, that allude to times of silence and why at times we're called upon to speak, but we don't. First of all, in Ecclesiastes 3:7, there's a familiar passage that reminds us there is a time to keep silent and there is a time to speak. What was this time for Aaron? And when you've had a moment, when you've had an experience, was it a time to speak or was it a time for silence? In Exodus chapter 14, and Moses said to the people, "Fear not, stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord." They've just been delivered from Egypt, and now they're penned between the approaching Egyptian army and the Red Sea. And Moses says, "Fear not, stand firm, see the salvation of the Lord, which will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent." Here they're directed by Moses to not speak so that they will not be distracted by their speaking and they can witness the hand of the Lord. Deuteronomy 27, "Then Moses and the Levitical priest said to all of Israel, 'Keep silence and hear, O Israel, this day. You have become the people of the Lord your God.'" This was at a time where they're standing at Mount Ebal and they're hearing the blessings and the curses. Blessings when you walk in God's ways. The curses you will experience when you rebel and don't walk in God's ways. And on that day, they are directed to keep silent and hear, O Israel, because today you are becoming the people of God, his Am Segula, his treasured possession. In the Talmud, we read, "More than what is found in this prayer, it is forbidden to recount the praise of the Holy One, blessed be he, for said Rabbi Eleazar, what is meant by what is written, he who would speak of God's greatness should recount all of his praise. For whom is it fitting to speak of God's greatness?" That's a question. It's a rhetorical one. The rabbis are trying to get people to be reflective. For whom is it fitting to speak of God's greatness? In other words, who is authorized? Who knows what they're talking about to be able to stand up and open their mouth and speak of God's greatness? "For one who cannot recount all of his praise," said Rabbi Bar Hana, said Rabbi Yohan, "one who recounts too much of God's praise is uprooted from the world. As is said, will it be told to him if I speak? If a person speaks, will it be swallowed?" And then Rabbi Judah, a man of Kefer Kiboraya, and some say a man of Kefer, expounded, "What is meant by what is written? For you, silence is praise. The cure for everything is silence." And then he goes on to say, "A word is worth a salah. It's a measure of money. Silence is worth two." You ever been in a situation like that? I've had those experiences in my life where I thought what I said was important. And then later when I reflected, I thought my silence would have been much more important. I should have kept silent rather than opening my mouth. The rabbis have taught on tonight authority. When a sage dies, the house of study that he conducted is dissolved. When the principal of a court dies, all houses of study in his town are dissolved. When the patriarch dies, all of the houses of study are dissolved. Rabbi Joshua ben Ora says, "It is not that they go out and just wander about the marketplace." In other words, instead of being in the house of study, when these folks have died, they dissolve the house of study. Now the students don't just go out into the marketplace and wander around, but rather they sit in silence and say neither a tradition nor a tale in the house of mourning. In other words, in the time of mourning, It's not what we have to say. It's our silence that carries value, which could be very helpful in informing you and I about how to support others in grief. And you might have thought to yourself, I just don't know what to say to them. Their loss is so difficult. And that's what sympathy does. We so identify with their deficit, we're at a loss on what we should do. Empathy is connecting with their asset. The Lord will encourage them. I just need to sit with them in silence. And in my silence, perhaps they will hear the still small voice of God. In the Talmud, there is a dispute as to whether in a case where one party claims that another owes him money and the other party remains silent, we should interpret the silence of the one as being an admission of obligation. Well, since you're not saying anything about it, then you must, in fact, admit that you owe me this money. Of course, the failure to respond to an accusation may be an act of concession, but it may equally well be means of indicating that the accused feels no need to respond to what he considers a baseless accusation. In other words, we want to be careful how we interpret someone's silence. They might be in agreement, or they just may be thinking, this is a baseless situation, a baseless accusation, and it's not deserving of a response from me. The words of the Kaddish, which is the prayer for mourners. The words of the Kaddish do not address the thoughts and feelings of the mourner. Instead, they are a praise of God. There is, however, an interesting custom which is reminiscent of Aaron's silence. It is the practice to omit from the mourner's Kaddish one of the paragraphs that is a part of the full Kaddish. This paragraph, which begins with the word Titkabel, states, may all the prayers and pleas of the people Israel find acceptance before their Father in heaven. And so the rabbi here asked the question, why is this paragraph omitted? It is, I believe, he said, the silence of Aaron. This omission is a declaration of disengagement. Yes, God, I will continue to pray to you and serve you, but I cannot be expected at this moment when you have taken from me the one I love to declare that you are the one who hears prayers. My prayer at least has gone unanswered. In this moment of mourning, I will not pretend otherwise. Can you appreciate the honesty of this? Can you appreciate the transparency and the authenticity even before God? Yes, God, I love you. Yes, God, I trust you. Yes, God, I know you hear prayers. But right now, my experience is you didn't hear my prayer. I have this loss. I've suffered this loss, or I've suffered this trauma, or someone that I care very deeply for has been deeply injured or has experienced adversity. And in this moment, this prayer wasn't answered. I still, God, know that you answered prayer, and I will still pray to you. But right now, I just can't confess that in this moment. I don't know about you, but I find that transparency, that level of authenticity, even before God, so refreshing. I have spent so much of my life in a church world that pretended otherwise and expected everyone to do the same pretense. Proverbs 26:4. This is the wisdom. Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. 2 Kings 18:36. But the people were silent and answered him not a word. This came at an occasion where the enemy king that was coming against Jerusalem at the time of Hezekiah's kingship, and he was making threats, and he was taunting Israel, taunting the watchmen on the wall. And Hezekiah had given the people a command, no matter what is said, no matter what the challenge, no matter what the taunt, do not speak, remain silent. And the people of Jerusalem were faithful to follow King Hezekiah's instructions. Do you remember the story of Zechariah, the husband of Elizabeth? And they give birth to the son John that we know from history as John the Baptist. Luke chapter 1. Now, while he, Zechariah, was serving as priest before God when his division was on duty, according to the custom of the priesthood, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and burn incense. By the way, this is likely on the day of Yom Kippur. He's entering in to light the incense. But the angel said to him, and so from his experience in being in the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur, this was his. So it's not unlikely he would have had an encounter with an angel speaking to him. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you will call his name John. And behold, you will be silent and unable to speak until the day that these things take place, because you did not believe my words, which were fulfilled in their time." So now we have a situation where silence is not only better, silence is not only commanded. Zechariah don't have a real choice in this. He's going to be silent because this constriction in his muscles and his throat is such that I'm not going to be talking for quite a while. Matthew 27, Yeshua is on trial after his arrest. Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" But he, Yeshua, gave him no answer, not even to a single charge. So the governor was greatly amazed. Same thing happened with Herod a little later when Herod questioned Yeshua for some length, but he made no answer. The wisdom literature, Sirach, chapter 20. There is a rebuke that is untimely, and there is a person who is wise enough to keep silent. How much better is it to rebuke than to fume? And the one who admits his fault will be kept from failure. Some people keep silent and are thought to be wise, while others are detested for being talkative. Some people keep silent because they have nothing to say, while others keep silent because they know when they speak. They know when to speak. The wise remain silent until the right moment, but a boasting fool misses the right moment. Whoever talks too much is detested, and whoever pretends to authority is hated. And probably one of my favorite stories in the entire Tanakh, the story of Hannah. You remember the story of Hannah? She's a sister wife. But she's the one who is not able to bear children. Her husband loves her deeply and, in fact, gives her double portions at time of meals. It's his, I don't know, if my wife couldn't have children and I made up for it by giving her a double portion of beef stew, I'm not sure that that really makes up for anything. A double portion of food doesn't take the place of having children, if having children is what you want. But that's what Elkanah was doing. He's a man. He's doing the best he can. But Hannah does so much more. Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. Hannah, she was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly, but she vowed a vow and said, "O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head." As she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart. Only her lips moved, and her voice was not heard. A silent cry. I don't know if you've experienced another person. I don't know, maybe me, you've experienced so grieved, so overwhelmed by the circumstances of life that you cried, but no sound came from you. I remember standing at the bedside in the hospital, and laying on the table was a 13-year-old girl on life support, the result of a very terrible automobile accident. And for several hours, in fact, for more than 2 days, parents had been standing by, hoping and praying their 13-year-old daughter would wake up. And when she was taken off of life support and in 90 seconds flatlined, both of them held each other and wept, and no sound could be heard. For several minutes, it was the sound of silence. Hannah was speaking in her heart, and only her lips moved, and her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli took her to be a drunken woman. You know, when you and I are looking at other people react to their circumstances, it is so easy to judge. And I'm here to tell you that our judgments are more often wrong than right. And I can tell you that our judgments are never, never, never helpful. On this day, the high priest is not a help. Sometimes only God understands. And the best support we can give to those who are silent is our loving, compassionate silence. Connor writes, while none of us ever wants to experience serious suffering in our lives, perhaps we can view our challenges as opportunities to grow into greater, more empathetic individuals. And for that, I 100% agree. 100% agree. I just want to echo and echo and echo these words from Connor Weisberg. Perhaps we can view our challenges as opportunities to grow into greater, more empathetic individuals. So how can you and I grow our empathy? How can we grow our compassion for ourselves and our compassion for others? Well, here's an insight from the words of Paul in Romans 12. Love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in love. Honor one another above yourselves. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with the Lord's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud. Be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath, for it is written, it is mine. I avenge, I will repay, says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not overcome evil. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And with that, I'll close the teaching and open it up for those of you who would like to ask a question or share a comment or an insight that you have. Feel free to unmute your mic and share with us.
Roderick, I have a comment and an observation.
Hey, David.
The first one is that the words of the Kaddish, that whole section there toward the bottom, to me that was, I think, one of the most profound things I think I've ever heard with regards to our relationship toward God. And just being honesty, and that's been a real thing I've been trying to work my way through and deal with for a while, is honesty before God and honesty before our fellows. And a lot of times in what you would call a church gathering or among religious friends, I have a tendency to speak in that lexicon of, when during the week I've never said the Lord did this or the Lord did that, but all of a sudden on Shabbat, the Lord's done this and the Lord's done that. Never speak of it again until the following Shabbat. And I thought, as I looked at that, and that hit me really hard, how hypocritical that is that so oftentimes we put on that face, or I put on that face of religiosity, to pretending to be something that I'm not, or pretending to feel something that I don't, so we'll be accepted by the other people that we are around who do express that. So to talk in that same vernacular, to me, as far as I was concerned, is very disingenuous and really hypocritical. And when you see something like this, to talk honestly with God and say, I will continue to pray to you, but right now, I don't see you as the God who answers my prayer. And the thing about it is, I believe that God can take that honesty. And God is perfectly fine with that honesty. Some people think, I could never say anything like that because the Lord would strike me dead. Or I could never express that feeling. And so I have to express these other feelings and so to curry God's favor. But that's not honest, really, in the human heart and the human situation. And so I think what really struck me so profoundly is be honest with God, because he knows already what you are. He knows you deeper than you know yourself. So you can't hide that from him by pretending to be something that you're not. He would much rather you be honest with him, warts and all, even Moses said, God, if you're not going to kill me along with everybody else. Abraham said, Lord, surely the leader of the universe is a just God. And he's just not going to go in and wipe all these people out. He pled with him on that. To me, being able to speak, yes, God's the sovereign of the universe, but he, that honesty is what is so, what struck me so profoundly about this part of the Kaddish is with the honesty with that. To speak to God honestly about what you're thinking. He already knows. So why try to hide it? And he can deal with you on that level. That was my feelings on that. And the other observation I wanted to make, which is really sort of kind of goes completely away from what I was just talking about, was, Romans 12:9-21, when he says, on the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing so, you will touch his heart and lead him to God. Well, that's not what it says. It says he'll heap burning coals on his head. To me, his day's coming. You don't have to worry about it. That was just that was just a strange way to express that, and I'm probably missing the whole point of that. But to me, that just stood out was, in treating him kindly and giving him this, you're going to lead them to God, and His Spirit will come upon them and stuff like that. But that's not what he's saying.
David, I appreciate your comments, David, and I think the larger point from what we were attempting to make from Romans 12 is not all of the individual things that we do, because sometimes we don't have it in us to do some of the things that Paul writes about in Romans 12. It's contextual, particularly when we're having a difficult moment and we've been impacted so strongly by the behaviors of others. And I'm talking about a negative impact. In that moment, doing those specific things is going to be difficult. But there's a bigger picture when we look at Romans 12. So if we don't look at just all the individual parts, but if we stand back and look at the bigger picture, what we see is all of that is focused on assets, not the deficits. And that's how you and I grow. We grow because we expand our strengths, not because we overcome our weaknesses. And that's not consistent with the society that you and I live in. Because the society we live in is always telling us to, you know, turn our weaknesses into strengths. But that's not what we read in Torah. Our focus is on what we have, what we've been apportioned. Think about how does Israel strengthen themselves in the 40 years wilderness wandering? They only gather enough manna that's apportioned for them for the day. And if they try to do more than that, it will work against them. And so we grow stronger and we become a resilient people because we find sufficiency in what the Lord has apportioned. That's our asset. And that is enough. It's enough for the day. And this is the heart of what Yeshua tells us in Matthew 6. This is why we don't worry about tomorrow. And we focus on today, because today we have been apportioned strength and we have been apportioned a challenge. And the strength and capacities we've been apportioned for today is sufficient to meet today's challenge. It's not sufficient for tomorrow's challenges, because tomorrow's not here yet. And when tomorrow comes, the Lord will resource us for that. And the more we seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, the more we become aware, our awareness increases of our assets. And many folks struggle to get, they struggle to find their resiliency in the midst of their trauma and their difficulty, because they're so focused on what they don't have. They're focused on what they wish they had had. They're focused on how they wish that it had gone differently, and they're missing, they're overlooking what's been apportioned. This is the story of Elijah. And he has this magnificent, miraculous moment on top of Mount Hermon, and he calls fire down out of heaven, and then he's running for his life, scared. And he runs into a cave. And there's a whirlwind, and he's looking for God in the whirlwind. And there's a big fire, a raging wildfire, and he's looking for God in the fire. And he's looking for God in the earthquake that comes. He's looking for God in the big dramatic. All of those things are destructive forces. For a moment, Elijah is focused on the deficits. He's focused on the trauma. He's focused on what's being destroyed. And the Lord is saying, I'm not in any of that. You want to find me? Silence. I'm in the still, small voice. And you and I will not hear still, small voices unless we're silent. And Elijah pleads his case before the Lord. I'm the only one who hasn't bowed his knee before the god Baal. And the Lord gently reminds him, oh no, I got 6,000 that have never bowed their knee before Baal. You think you're alone, and you think you're alone because you're so focused on your deficit. When you get quiet and you realize your assets, you'll see you're not alone. There's 6,000 standing right there with you, Elijah. You just haven't seen them. You're not alone. Comments, questions?
Right.
Charlene.
Thank you. Thank you for this lesson. Even though it was heavy in a sense, I mean, a lot to think about, but I think it helps so much to know how to be there for people, you know, in a way that, you know, I hadn't thought. Because sometimes you think, you feel like you want to say something, but you really don't have anything to say, you know, but it's knowing that it's okay just to be there you know, and comfort. And I always wondered why Aaron didn't say anything during that time. So this was really helpful. Thank you.
You're most welcome, Charlene. And I'm glad it was a blessing.
I agree with Charlene's comment. This was a very helpful study, especially with my history and things that I've dealt with. So
yeah,
very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. And you know, the world that we live in right now is in turmoil. And, you know, some people are focused on what they don't have. And then when they get what they said they wanted, it's not enough. Because, and Solomon writes about this in the Proverbs, that the more we are focused on what we don't have, the more when we get doesn't satisfy. And there's a spiritual gluttony. And I argue differently than the way I've heard the narrative growing up in the church world. Growing up in the church world, I was always told that there is a spiritual lack in the world. I don't think so. I don't think there's a spiritual lack. I think people are very spiritual. Everywhere. I think a lot of people are not aware of their spirit. They neglect it. Just like some people neglect physical self-care or they neglect their psychological self-care, a lot of people have been neglecting their spiritual self-care. Not because they're not spiritual. They've just been neglecting it. And when we feed it, when we care for it, when we nurture all the parts of us. Now, I live in a desert, and there's a long time in the desert here that the desert's brown and dusty. But this time of the year, there's blossoms and there's grass on the desert floor. And all that needed was just a little cooler temperature, a little bit of water, a little bit of nurture, and it comes alive. During the drought, you wouldn't think anything could grow there except cacti. Right now, there's wildflowers growing on the desert floor everywhere. So what's our potential if we just nurtured it? What's that other person's capacity? We just nurtured it. Comments, questions?
You have some in the chat, Roderick.
Thank you for bringing my attention to that. Rivka writes, thank you, Roderick. My chiropractor would post Tylenol nightmares on the office bulletin board ever so often. Liver failure increased 300% after Tylenol was released over the counter amongst 100 other horrors, such as yours today. Shabbat shalom, everyone. My friend here wants to drive around the lake, so I think Rivka was saying goodbye. I think that's what she was doing. Dave and Amy, excellent point. Strength to meet today's challenge. Day I knew. Yes. Day I knew. Absolutely. It would be enough. Wanda writes, great study, Roderick. Thank you. Appreciate that, Wanda. As Charlene said so many times, you want to say something to someone who is feeling pain and no words come to mind. Now I know it's okay to be silent. Being there can bring a strength to someone. Yeah. Hey, Joe.
Hello, Roderick, and Shabbat Shalom, everybody. So I'm not sure. I always confuse empathy and sympathy. I have to stop and think about them when I talk about them because I get them confused. And I think I have an example of each something I've experienced in my own life. So I've read through...
Awesome.
Excuse me, sorry. Sorry about that. So I've read through the story of the death of Nadab and Abihu, I'm sure dozens of times throughout my life. And, you know, you read about Aaron's reaction and ponder it a little bit and kind of, I guess you can sympathize and think about how difficult that may be. I've never lost a child, so I don't know what it's like. Not until I lost my wife. And then the next time that story came up, I realized how difficult it must have been because, I mean, my world was just torn apart. So I had a different perspective on the story that I had never had before, where I can now, I believe, empathize with Aaron. And I just, prior to that, I would read his reaction and I would think that that was odd or strange, or maybe he didn't handle it properly. But like I said, now I have a different perspective. But one of the other things is, at that time, I had a lot of friends, whether through friends, family, through the congregation that I used to be a part of, that had reached out to me in one way or another, whether it was through a phone call or text or social media after my wife had passed. And that was comforting, you know, the response from people. And there was one individual that him and I wouldn't say we were good friends, but at the congregation, we would always talk and we got along real well and we'd have great conversations. We never exchanged phone numbers, so outside of the congregation, I never spoke to him. But I was friends with his wife on Facebook, and he didn't have Facebook because he doesn't do Facebook. He doesn't do social media. So I had actually received a message from his wife, but never from him. But it didn't bother me. But I did notice that I hadn't heard from him, but it wasn't an issue. Well, about a year later, his, I believe, 22-year-old son died in a car accident. And I went to the funeral, and I was talking to him, and I guess he didn't recognize me because we hadn't seen each other in a couple of years. He didn't recognize me. And then finally he says, "Oh my gosh, Joseph, it's you." He says, "I didn't realize it was you." And he said, "I am so sorry I never reached out to you about your wife." And he says, "I will never let that happen again." And not speaking of my wife, but if ever anybody, you know, loses somebody, and for whatever reason, I don't know, and he didn't explain, and I didn't ask, it didn't matter. But again, kind of one of those situations where if you haven't experienced it, you're kind of looking at it from the outside. And anyhow, those were just a couple of examples that I would thought to yes. share. But it is different, the sympathy and the empathy and having that perspective, which again, I mean, they're tragic moments that can, it set me back a ways, but, you know, and it's something that it takes time to work through, but hopefully in the long run, it makes us stronger and we're able to build upon it in a positive way. And you can now empathize and be there for people in a way before that you couldn't. So
yes,
that was all. Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph. It's good to hear from you. When we are in relationship with people, when we're truly in a relationship, specifically one of that's built on trust. In that trust relationship, we learn when to speak and when to be silent. And sometimes we learn by making mistakes. I have. I still do. Marilyn.
Thank you, Dr. Logan. What I wanted to say was not meant, it was that, you know, sometimes I would be with a person, especially a good friend or something, and I couldn't say anything. I may hold their hand for a minute, a hug for a minute or two, then let go and hold their hand, and, you know, and that's all. But I went away thinking, why couldn't I say anything? I felt guilty that I couldn't say anything. That used to bug me. You know, I thought I was just couldn't speak, you know. You know, so this helped me a lot. Thank you.
You're most welcome. Thank you for sharing your comment. I think we've all had those experiences from different times. What do we say? And as Joseph pointed out, there is a time to speak. There is a time to reach out. There is a time to contact people and to at least make our presence known to them. But what doesn't help is feeling guilty because you did say something or feeling guilty because you didn't say something. Guilt is just an ineffective way of managing life. And when your heart is attempting to show love, you know, sometimes it's not too effective and we learn to do better, but we want to give ourselves a break. These are difficult moments. And one of the things that makes them so difficult is there's no two that's alike. When you've experienced loss and somebody else has experienced loss, there's some similarities, but they're not the same. It's just, and that makes it difficult. That makes it messy. Being human is messy. And God gives us his tender, loving care. He gives us his compassion. Here's what I've discovered in my personal journeys. I used to think that clarity was the most important thing I could have. I need clarity so I know what to do and be right and be accurate. And I have found that clarity is good and it's helpful, but it's not the most important thing. I have found that what's more important than clarity is being together. And whatever happens, not letting it separate us. And evidently, God feels the same way because he said, there's no height, no depth, no breadth. There's no anything above the earth, below the earth that can separate us from the love of God. So if nothing can separate us from God's love, it seems to me that we should be just as eager to not be separated from each other. Even if we don't have clarity, even if we don't have all of our answers to the questions, even if we can't figure everything out, even if we're still doing the dance, do I speak, do I not speak? Do I speak, do I not speak? It's an awkward dance. Play the dance. Do it. Just don't let it divide us. Ed writes, thank you, Dr. Logan. That lesson helped me realize and accept that I have permission to be silent. And Ed said he really needed that message. May the Lord provide for you, Ed. May the Lord provide for all of us. Beth Ann writes, this was such a great study and on so many levels. I'm going through some difficult times right now, not personally, but with my son and his family. It looks like there may be a divorce. It's hard for me, and at times I'm at a loss for how to respond and what to say. This today was very helpful. Thank you so much. Prayers appreciated. Love you all. So, Father, on behalf of Beth Ann, we ask that you would provide for her, her son, and his family. May your wisdom be known. May love be without a price tag. And may there be togetherness. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Other comments or questions? Angela. By the way, this is Angela's second time with us, and she's from Pennsylvania. So all of you, wave at Angela.
Shabbat shalom.
Glad you're with us, Angela.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah, I have a question about being silent and hearing the still small voice. When I'm assuming a lot of that is in prayer, and it's really hard to do. I was wondering, you know, to quiet your brain enough, where, I mean, is it to the point where there's no thoughts coming in? I mean, or I was just talking to someone about this, another girl in a different congregation today, and she goes, did you get any tips on hearing the still small voice? You know, and yeah, I got one today, but any pointers? Like how to?
So, The idea of a still small voice is a Hebrew saying. It's an idiom. And essentially it's communicating to quiet ourselves. Now, it's, you know, if I'm talking a lot and someone else is whispering, I'm not likely to hear them whispering, no matter how important what they're saying. If I'm just talking, or if I'm rustling papers, or if I'm busy. But let's move that from the outer environment to the inner environment. And this is personified in the story of Israel. They were in slavery in the house of bondage in Egypt for 430 years. And then God took them out of Egypt. But for the next 40 years, wandering in the wilderness, he's trying to get the Egypt out of them. They're no longer slaves, but all of their life's reference points is from a slavery mentality. And so what is helpful is when you and I can quiet ourselves. And that might have to do with vocal speech, being quiet. And not being busy with their hands. But it's also about quieting our soul, quieting our interior, our inner environment, which means, and if I can come back to the nervous systems, when the sympathetic or the dorsal vagal is dominant, it's because our body is perceiving threat and it's in a reactive mode. And in that reactive mode, we experience muscle tension because the body's energy is rising. It's a body arousal experience. And the higher we have body arousal, the more we're reactive. And the more we're in what's called a survival mode. And that's essentially what's going on in Israel for 40 years. They're in survival mode. And the Lord wants to give them a transforming experience so that when they move into the land of promise, that they can occupy the land, that they can no longer be nomadic. They can build homes. They can plant vineyards. They can plant their gardens. They can raise their cattle. They can establish a center of life, a community, a nation. They can be the Amsugala, the God's treasured people. You are God's treasured people. We are God's treasured people. And we are best able to recognize that when we are calm. And we're more likely to discern the Torah. We're more likely to discern God's instructions. We're more likely to discern what it means to walk in His ways when we are calm and intentional rather than excited, aroused, and reactive. Does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Anyone else?
Well, a quick question. Are those three parts of our brains active when we're sleeping too?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. And in fact, when your body reaches REM sleep, which is the most, your body is relaxed, but your mind is very active. And REM sleep is the deepest sleep, but it's also when the brain is the most active. REM being rapid eye movement. Your eyes are rapidly moving left and right. That's a lot of energy. Well, that's a positive energy, because REM sleep is where the human body is designed to process 80% of your day's stress. Process it and release it. Anybody ever heard of EMDR therapy? It's a type of therapy that therapists use called EMDR, and it's a synthetic way of doing rapid eye movement left and right during a therapy session. And that's helpful for people who are not achieving REM sleep. And during a therapy session, it can help the body to release the stress that it's holding on to, because when the body holds on to stress, and the body holds on to stress through muscle tension. So this goes back to Angela, what we were talking just now about. Stress is not a psychological thing. Stress is not a psychological phenomenon. Stress is a physiological phenomenon. It is impossible for stress to remain in a relaxed muscle body. It's biologically impossible. So the more you can have a relaxed body, the less your body's holding on to stress, because the longer your body holds on to stress, it becomes toxic. That's a spiritual principle we understand from Torah. Yeshua says in Matthew 6, don't worry about tomorrow. Don't have body arousal about what's not yet happened. Relax and just deal with today. And what do we read in Hebrews? Why Israel did not enter into the promised land the first time, but instead spent 40 years in the wilderness, because they could not enter into the rest. Think about the language that the writer in Hebrews uses. They could not enter into rest. What keeps us deficient? We can't enter into rest. That's true physically. That's true psychologically. It's true emotionally. It's true spiritually. It's true relationally. And the more we rest, the more we relax, the more we calm the mind, the more we're likely to trust each other. The more likely we are to stay together. And when we stay together, now we can collaborate on those challenges and those traumatic situations and those difficult seasons. We can deal with it together. Even if it's weeping together. Comments, questions?
Thank you, Dr. Logan. That was really helpful. For what you just said, it just like I could take a breath. I go, that's what I always needed. So I really appreciate the lesson, and I appreciate you. So thank you.
It's good to hear from you, Bonita. Thank you for your comment. Amy.
Yes. I have the sympathetic and the dorsal. What was that first one again?
Ventral vagal.
Ventral. Okay.
Ventral vagal, that's V-E-N-T-R-A-L, ventral vagal, the sympathetic, and then the dorsal vagal. Those are the three primary nervous systems. Now,
so
when this top one is dominant, these are working too, but they're not working independent. They're working subservient to the ventral vagal. Well, by the way, did you know that this is found in the Book of Kings as a Torah principle? It's called Melech, which is the acronym for king. So the M is the Hebrew word for mind. And then the heart. And then the kishka, the guts. And when you spell Melech, M-L-K, in Hebrew, or transliterating the letters. Then the mind, or the ventral vagal, is the dominant voice. So the heart and our gut feeling, which is our reactive mode, that's the dorsal vagal, they're subservient to the ventral vagal. And that makes for right authority, king. What happens if that gets flipped? And so it's not melek anymore, it's kelim. So it's K-L-M, and that's the word for chaos.
The word for chaos?
Yes, ma'am.
Wow.
King spelled backwards in Hebrew is chaos. So when my gut is in charge of my brain, when my dorsal vagal is dominant over my ventral vagal, you get chaos. Torah principle. And what I showed you today is brain science. And God said it 5,000 years ago.
This was just great, Roderick. Thank you.
Appreciate the comment, Beth Ann. Thank you. Wanda, you're grinning awful big. But then again, you always do. You light up my life.
Learning about God puts that smile on my face.
Yeah.
I can't help it.
Me too. Anyone else?
This was excellent, Dr. Logan. It's always good to be able to look at the analogies of what we discover and find them in the Torah. So it just reinforces just how much God is just very, you know, so full of wisdom and plans out so many things that we discover. So it's Amen. Great. Thank you.
You're most welcome. It's good to hear from you, Mark.
Thank you, Dr. Logan. Excellent as always.
Sandra, good to hear from you. Thank you. Give my respects to Avery.
I sure will.
Well, thank you for being a part of today's study. May the Lord bless you, grant you his shalom. May he cause your countenance to rise. And let's see, I have to do this. Joseph always laughs at me because I can't do this without a help. Live long and prosper.
Let's see if I can do that. There you go.
Ah, Ed, you're showing off. My wife can do it, but I can't without a little help.
I can only do it with one hand, though. Can't do
I get by other. With a little help from my friends. And in a large tack. Be well, be blessed, live long and prosper. I'll look forward to our time together next.
Same to you, Dr. Logan.
Shalom, everyone.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
Well done, Dr. Logan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.